In modern worship, it's not at all uncommon to hear worshipers either sing or say, "I love you, Lord," or "I love you, God." We have several songs in our hymnals that say that. I love you, Lord, and I lift up my voice to praise you, to thank you, and so forth. Probably at least once a church service during prayers, I'll hear one of the men say, "I love you, Lord," or "We love you, Lord," or "We love you, God," or "We love you, Jesus." Now, first of all, I don't have a problem with that. I want to make that clear. But I find it odd that you don't find that language in the Bible. How does that strike you? There's only four places that I can think of in the Bible where, actually two, where it says, "I love you," and it's either talking to God or to Jesus. That language is extremely rare in the Bible. I think there are some reasons for that. One of the usages is Psalm 18. Psalm 18. And this is probably the most familiar one. Psalm 18, verse 1. David said, this is after he had been delivered, "I love you, O Lord, my strength." Now, the funny thing about that, yes, that does say, "I love you," sort of. The verb that he uses there is not the normal word for love. That's the first thing that is odd about that verse. It's a word that doesn't really, the normal word for love is ahev in Hebrew. Normal word, not used here. It's a different word, rakav. And that word generally means to have pity or compassion on. Now, usually when that word is used in the Old Testament, it's talking about God's pity on us. And so he uses this really odd word to describe his love for God. Pity or compassion on God, that doesn't make a great deal of sense. That's odd in itself. And then he uses an extremely rare form of the verb. This is the only place in the Old Testament where this form of this verb is used. So technically, yes, he does say, "I love you," but in probably the weirdest way possible. You know, some men, when they try to propose to their wives or when they try to express their love to their wives, they're weird. And that's almost what he does here. It's done in an extremely unusual way. There's another text in the book of Psalms, Psalm 116. Psalm 116. In verse 1, "I love the Lord because he hears my voice and my supplications." Now, it doesn't say, "I love you." Again, there's only two places in the Bible where that language is used. Here he says it in the third person, "I love the Lord." And here again, there's some unusual features. In the actual Hebrew text, the word love doesn't have an object. What it actually says is, "I love the Lord." The English version say, "I love the Lord because he hears my voice and supplications." Literally, it says, "I love because the Lord hears." I love because the Lord hears. Now, you could say, okay, it's an implied thing. But nonetheless, it doesn't really say, "I love you, Lord." 1 John 4, it's used in a hypothetical way when John is talking about compassion that lacks compassion. 1 John chapter 4, verse 20, "If someone says, 'I love God,' and hates his brother, he is a liar, for the one who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen." Here again, he's not saying specifically, "I love you, Lord." It's in the third person, "I love God." Now, the one conversation where that language is used, it's an actual conversation, comes from John chapter 21, when Jesus restores Peter. That's how we describe that text. It's one of the most touching conversations in the Bible. John chapter 21, Jesus has been raised from the dead. He's been raised from the dead at least a week, and probably more like two or three or even more than that. He meets with his disciples at the Sea of Galilee. Now, there's only seven disciples who are present on this occasion. And Jesus has a specific conversation with Peter. Now, we know why. Because earlier in John's text, actually earlier in all the Gospels, John is the one who denied even knowing, or Peter is the one who denied even knowing Jesus He denied him three times. And three times in this text, Jesus says, "Do you love me, Peter?" And so in John 21, verse 15, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" And he said, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And he said to him, "Tend my lambs." He said to him again a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Shepherd my sheep." Verse 17, he said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." That's an interesting conversation at so many levels. But one of the things I think is most interesting is that Jesus and John use different words for love. The first two times Jesus asks Peter, Peter, that's the guy here. I'll get to that in a minute. The first two times that Jesus asks Peter the question, he uses the word agape. And that's the word that we call Christian love. Agape, concern for the well-being of someone else. "Peter, do you agape me?" And every time, all three times that Peter answers, he doesn't use the word agape. He uses the word phileo, which is more of a term about affection. "Peter, do you agape me?" And Peter says, "I have affection for you, Lord." The last time that Jesus asks, he changes his word. "Do you phileo me?" And Peter says, "Lord, you know I phileo you." Now, there's a lot of speculation about what that involves. I can't help but wonder if maybe Peter is reluctant just to come out and say, "I agape you," for a couple of reasons. One, because Jews just didn't say that. We just surveyed the Old Testament. It just doesn't happen in the Old Testament. But there's also Peter's glaring failure staring him in the face. Just a few weeks before, he had just flat out denied knowing Jesus, and I'm sure that was an embarrassment for him. And I don't know if you've ever had to deal with repetitive sin in your life, things that you struggle with time and time and time again, and you vow for the 100th time, "I'm done with this, I'm never doing it again," and then you do it again, and you throw up your hands in despair and say, "What is the point?" And you're reluctant to even make any promises to God. And I think that's some of the dynamic here at work. There are lots of references in the Bible, both Old Testament and New Testament, that we're commanded to love God. And it's almost always in the third person. You are to love the Lord your God. You just don't see much of, "I love you, God." Again, I'm not saying it's sinful to do that. I'm just saying the Bible doesn't really say that all that much, which I think is awfully odd. You do see the Bible, biblical writers, particularly in Psalms, particularly in Psalm 119. "I love your law, O God. I love your precepts, O God." Psalm 28, "I love the dwelling place of God." They express all kinds of ways about loving God, but they just don't come right and say, "I love you, God." I want us to look at the concept today of loving God. What does that mean? What does that mean? We're going to look at Deuteronomy chapter 6. So turn in your Bibles to Deuteronomy 6. We're continuing our theme for this year. Our theme for this year is "How Firm a Foundation." We're looking at some of the great texts in the Bible. And back in, I think, November or December, we were kind of making up the list, and I had a list, and Tim had a list, and Eric had a list, and we kind of all meshed it. And this was on Eric's list, and he said, "Really, really would like to hear that preached." I'd preached on it actually not too long ago, so I was a little bit reluctant, but I think Eric's right. This is such a pivotal text in the Bible. It was such an important text that when Jesus was once asked, "So what's the greatest commandment in the Bible?" You know what his answer was? Deuteronomy 6, "You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all your might." So Jesus thought it was a pretty important verse. So I want us to look at this verse. In many ways, this is the heart of what it means to be a child of God. In many ways, this is the theological center of the Old Testament in terms of our response to God. So I think Deuteronomy 6 is worth looking at this morning. What does it mean to love the Lord? What does it mean to love the Lord? So in verse 1, now this is the commandment, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you, that you might do them in the land where you are going over to possess it, so that you and your son and your grandson might fear the Lord your God, to keep all his statutes and his commandments which I command you all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it, that it may be well with you, that you may multiply greatly, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you in the land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. And it shall come about when the Lord your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, great and splendid cities which you did not build, and houses full of all good things which you did not fill, and hewn cisterns which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, and you eat and are satisfied, then watch yourself that you do not forget the Lord who brought you from the land of Egypt out of the house of slavery. You shall fear only the Lord your God, and you shall worship him and swear by his name. You shall not follow other gods, any of the gods of the peoples who surround you, for the Lord your God in the midst of you is a jealous God. Otherwise, the anger of the Lord your God will be kindled against you, and he will wipe you off the face of the earth. You shall not put the Lord your God to the test as you tested him at Massah. You should diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God and his testimonies and his statutes which he has commanded you. You shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord, that it may be well with you, and that you may go in and possess the good land which the Lord swore to give to your fathers, by driving out all your enemies from before you, as the Lord has spoken. When your son asks you in time to come, saying, what do the testimonies and the statutes and the judgments mean which the Lord your God commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us from Egypt with a mighty hand. Moreover, the Lord showed great and distressing signs and wonders before our eyes against Egypt, Pharaoh, and all his household. He brought us out from there in order to bring us in, to give us the land which he had sworn to our fathers. So the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God, for our good always and for our survival as it is today. It will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe all this commandment before the Lord our God, just as he commanded us. That's Deuteronomy 6. That's such a powerful text. It's a wide-ranging text. But it lies at the heart of what it meant to be a child of God. The emphasis in the text is really on how Israel responds to this reality about God. Now, I want you to notice that the text starts with a word, and it ends with a word, and that word is commandment. Now, it's interesting because if you look in chapter 6, verse 1, this is the commandment, singular, followed by the statutes, plural, the judgments, plural, which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you. And verse 2, he mentions statutes, plural, commandments, plural. And he uses language like that through the chapter. But he starts and he ends with that singular form of the word, commandment. And I think that's a key to understanding how the book of Deuteronomy is put together. If you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 5, this tells us what the book is about. Across the Jordan in the land of Moab, Moses undertook to expound this law. Deuteronomy is Moses' exposition of the law. Now, we're told it's in the plains of Moab. They are across the Jordan River from the Promised Land. This is the second generation of Israelites who came out of the Promised Land. Their fathers, their parents, and their grandparents all died because of their disobedience. They were penalized by having to wander for 40 years in the wilderness. This is the new generation. They were kids when they came out. They are going to be the future leaders of the nation when they cross over under the leadership of Joshua. Moses is not allowed to enter the land, so he says, I need to tell you what's important. And basically, Deuteronomy is a series of about three sermons and some additional material where he basically exhorts this new generation, you have got to be faithful to God. Don't make the same mistakes your fathers made. So Deuteronomy 1 verse 5, this book is Moses' exposition of the law. Now the first four chapters answer the question, how did we get here? How did we get into this mess? How have we arrived here in the plains of Moab? What happened? Why did it take so long for us to go get all the way to the Promised Land? That's what chapters 1 through 4 are about. He basically says, you didn't obey God. Then starting in chapter 5, you've got a repeat of the Ten Commandments. There are some interesting differences between the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy 5 and the Ten Commandments back in Exodus 20, but nonetheless, basically he repeats the Ten Commandments. Then chapters 6 through 11 are Moses, I think, exposition of what it means to fear the Lord. It's foundational. Then when you get to chapter 12 through chapter 26 is all the law stuff. It's the laws, the statutes, the judgments. But by using the singular form, this is the commandment. I think chapters 6 through 11 are an elaboration on the very first commandment. God said, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. And they were to remember this Lord. They were not to substitute anything, any kind of idol in his place. They were to love the Lord. And this is what chapters 6 through 11 are all about. It's his exposition of that very first command. What does it mean? So he hones in on this idea of loving the Lord and fearing the Lord. The fact that he mentions it as the commandment. Do you remember the question to Jesus in Matthew chapter 22, Mark chapter 12? What is the greatest commandment? And I think that's why he points to Deuteronomy 6. Obviously, there's the logic. There's nothing greater than loving God. But the chapter begins by, this is the commandment. What commandment? To love the Lord your God. And then the rest of it is just commentary on that. That's why the plural, judgments, statutes, ordinances, commands, laws, and so forth, those are simply commentaries on this one thing. What does it mean to love the Lord? He says several times in this chapter, if you do it, it will be well for you. And he's looking into the Promised Land. Once you get to the Promised Land, it will be well with you. It will affect you in a positive way. There will be blessings that come if you will do what the Lord says. If you will continue to do what the Lord says, if you will continue to obey the Lord, then good things will happen. And not just for them, but for future generations of Israelites as well. This wasn't just a momentary, temporary thing. This wasn't like, well, let's just get you across the river and then you can do whatever you want to. No, no, no. This is generational. This is something that will affect them and their children and their grandchildren, and they need to be aware of all of those implications. Now, the heart of this is what he says in verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Now, this is called the Shema, and it's based on the very first word in that verse. The Hebrew word for hear is Shema. So, Shema Israel. Listen, Israel. Pay attention, Israel. Hear, O Israel. Then he says two statements. There's three clauses in this verse. Shema Israel. And then he says, Yahweh is God. Yahweh is one. That's all he says. In fact, the second two clauses don't even have verbs in them. Yahweh, God, Yahweh, one is how it literally reads. He's making a statement about God. Now, most of the chapter is a statement about Israel and her relationship to God, but he starts out with this statement about God. There's something unique about God. Hear Israel, Yahweh, and Yahweh was the covenant identity of God in the Old Testament. Who was Israel's covenant God? Every nation had its own particular deity. Who was Israel's deity? It was Yahweh. He was not one of many. He was God alone. God in a unique way. So Yahweh is God, not Baal, not anybody else. Only Yahweh is God. But I don't even think here the emphasis is on the number of God. It's on the uniqueness of God. You can translate that last phrase as being Yahweh is one, and that's a possible translation. But you can also say Yahweh alone. Yahweh is uniquely God. I think the emphasis is on the uniqueness of God. There is no other God like Him. We sing a song sometimes, there is none like Him, none can compare, no God His equal, no prince His heir. There is not just one God, but this God is unlike anything you can imagine. Hear, O Israel, Yahweh is God, Yahweh only, Yahweh alone. So what are you supposed to do with that? Again, it makes a statement about God, but now Israel is expected to take that truth and do something with it. The response is in verse 5. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. Really starting very early in chapter 6 and running almost continually through it, there is just word after word, there's verb after verb, which tells the response they're supposed to have. So in verse 2, they are to fear the Lord their God. In verse 4, they are to hear the Lord their God. Verse 5, they are to love the Lord their God. Verse 7, you are to teach your children. They are to teach in response to the Lord their God. Verse 7, they are to talk about the Lord their God. Verse 8, they are to bind these words of God on their foreheads. And verse 9, they are to write these things out. Just several imperative verbs emphasizing this is what you do about the reality of God. It's one thing to say that you believe in God. It's another thing to act on that belief. I believe intellectually up here in my brain cells that I should lose weight. Ask me how I'm doing. Apparently I don't believe it strongly enough because I hadn't done much about it. Well, I did cut back on Cokes last week. But there is this intellectual knowledge that we have, but until we put it into action, it's just a bunch of useless facts. It's not enough to believe that God exists. It's not enough to believe that the God in the Bible is the main guy. It's not enough just to have an intellectual acceptance of that information. What you have to do is act upon it. And that's the relationship between verses 4 and 5 in the text. Here is God. Here is Yahweh. Here is the Lord. And this Lord is unique among anything that claims to be God, anything that men can exalt as God. Israel's God is unique among all of them. He is the real God. He is the true and the living God. He is the only God. So Israel, what are you going to do about it? And the answer then comes in verse 5. You are to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. Heart is used so much in the Old Testament. Scores of times in the Old Testament to denote the inner man. It's synonymous with the inner man. Sometimes it deals with the intellect. Sometimes it deals with the emotions. Often it's dealing with the will. But he's saying you love God from the inside out. You start with your fundamental allegiance to God. You're not just your belief in Him, but a commitment to Him. That's what it means to love God with all your heart, all of your heart. When two people fall in love and when they eventually decide to get married, you better love that person with all your heart or you're going to have a bad marriage. There is a fundamental commitment that you make to the other person because you understand who they are and you want to have a relationship with them. the commitment proceeds from the appreciation that you have with the other person. You love that person. You love the Lord your God with all that you are, the inner man. He says you love him with all your soul. I think soul here just represents life. Sometimes soul is used in the Old Testament to describe the inner man. Sometimes it's almost synonymous with heart. But I think he's making a little bit of a distinction. Soul is sometimes just life, your existence. Your very existence is a testimony to your relationship to God. And every bit of your energy, every bit of your talent, everything that you have, every breath you take reflects on your commitment to God. And then finally he says, with all your might. Might represents your resources. Whether it's money, whether it's physical ability, whether it's talent, whatever it is, you give that to God as well. You turn the whole thing over to God. That's what it means to love God. You love him from the inside out. You love him with your affections, your will, your resources. The very breath that you take, everything in your life is turned over to the Lord, and no exceptions. You don't hold anything back. Back during the Crusades, there were a lot of so-called Christian kings would hire mercenary soldiers to go and help them fight the holy wars in the Middle East. And what they would do is these mercenaries were pagans. They couldn't care less about religion, but the Crusaders were Christians, and so they wanted a Christian army. And so they would require that these mercenary soldiers had to be baptized. Kind of a neat little loophole to get them into the holy war concept. But basically they would baptize them. What many of these pagans would do is they would be baptized, but they would take their swords and hold them out of the water. In other words, they're saying, you're not taking my sword. You can have most of me, but you're not going to get all of me. There have been a few people I baptized. I think I saw them holding their wallets out of the water. You can have most of me, but you can't have all of me. Or their cell phones, or their car keys, or whatever else. There are far too many professed Christians who have not given everything to the Lord. When you come to the Lord, you give him everything. Every relationship, every possession, every priority, every thought, every act belongs to him as God. And it spills over into every facet of life. I love verses 6 and 7 and 8. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons and talk of them when you sit in your way, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. In other words, if you are wholly committed to God, talking about God ought to be the easiest thing in the world. I sometimes wonder if maybe that's our problem with evangelism. We are so reluctant to say anything. Well, when you are wholly committed to the Lord, it's not that hard. It should be the most natural thing in your life. When you get up in the morning, you start with thoughts of God. When you go to bed at night, you end with thoughts of God. And every place you go during the day, walking along the way, sitting in, at your office, you're thinking about God. That's where evangelism comes from. What fills your heart? Remember Jesus said, the mouth speaks out of that which fills the heart? When your heart is full of God, when your heart is full of His Word, when your heart is full of the Spirit of God, it's full of Jesus as Lord, what else are you going to talk about? It ought to be the most natural thing in the world, the easiest thing in the world, because we are consumed by thoughts of God. And that's how we transmit this to our kids. I don't think he's talking about formal Christian education in verse 7. I think he's talking about what we sometimes refer to as teachable moments. Something comes up in the course of your conversation, and it's like, okay, here's an opportunity. I've been wanting to talk about this. Let's talk about this. When the kids were young, a lot of times Alethea would be giving them rides to and from school, and particularly Nate. Sometimes getting Nate to talk about what you wanted him to talk about was just nigh to impossible. But what she discovered is on these long rides to and from school and football practice and track meets and all that kind of stuff, miles and miles and miles every day, if you let him run his mouth enough, he'd eventually say something worth listening to. He would eventually say something that's like, that's what we're after. And she was especially good at seizing those moments. Okay, let's talk about this. I tended more toward the brute force approach, and they just didn't talk to me, so, you know. But you seize these moments, and you use them. And that's the same thing with evangelism. If we go into evangelism with a whole bunch of canned speeches, it's not going to work that well. You use the opportunities that are presented to you. And that's how we express this love for God. Now, I want to make two applications. Again, let's look at what Jesus said. Turn over to Mark's account, Mark chapter 12. I've mentioned this already, but Jesus said this is one of the two greatest commandments, and of the two, this is the greatest. Of all the things you could do to please God, this is rule number one. And so in Mark chapter 12, verse 28, one of the scribes came and heard them arguing, recognizing that Jesus had answered them well. He asked him, what commandment is the foremost of all? Trying to get Jesus into some profound theological conversation, maybe trip him up, get him into an argument with the rabbis, and their work would be done. And Jesus knew the exact answer. The foremost is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And the second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. That's it. If you can remember and do those two things, you're doing well. But think about the implications of it. You must love God more than anyone or anything else in your life. Easier said than done. I don't know how many times I've had this conversation, sometimes with people who are not Christians. Sometimes I've heard Christians gripe about this. You're going to tell me I have to love God more than I love my wife? I'm not going to say that. Jesus did. You're going to tell me I have to love Jesus more than I love my husband? That's what he said. You're going to tell me that I have to love God more than I love my own children? That's exactly what he's saying. And if you don't believe that formulation, turn over to Luke chapter 14. Just to make it clear, Luke chapter 14, verse 25, large crowds were going along with him, and he turned and he said to them, Jesus had this disdain for crowds. He was always suspicious of crowds because he always knew there'd be dead weight there. There would be people there who just following along because there's a crowd there. And so he turned to this crowd, and that verb indicates it was a sudden turnaround, and he says to them, If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers, and yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Now, the Bible warns us against hatred, and here the term hate is contrasted with love. It's actually an Old Testament metaphor. And it actually comes from the book of Malachi where God said, Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated. That's not animosity, it's the language of choice. I have chosen one and I have not chosen the other. Or I have chosen one above the other. It's a relativistic thing. If you look at your love for Jesus, it is so much greater than anything else in your life, it kind of looks like hatred. But here's the deal. If you love God more than anything else, you'll do what He says as a husband. You'll do what He says as a wife. You'll do what He says as a parent, and He'll take care of that. And that's the part that so many people don't get. Do you love God more than any person or anything in your life? Look at the thing part. Can you honestly say that you love God more than you love your job? More than you love your possessions? More than you love your money? More than you love your education? More than you love your career? If someone were to look at your life and see how you spend your time, how you make your decisions, would they see someone who loves God more than anything? And be honest. By how you make your decisions, how you spend your time, how you spend your money, how you rank your weekly, daily priorities, is there anything in your life that is more important than God? Is there any area where you have kind of put God to the side and said, well, when I get done with this, Lord, we'll have a chat? Is there any area in your life where you possibly have given God less than 100%? If that's the case, you're not loving God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. And the other application, we kind of touched on it a moment ago, is there any person in your life that you love more than God? Is there any person in your life that you love more than God? Be careful how you answer that. Be careful how you answer that. There is an example in the Old Testament, and for years I really wasn't sure what the answer was. Over in 2 Samuel, this is the story of David as his rule has finally been consolidated. And he has wanted all along to bring the Ark of the Covenant and the Tabernacle into the city of Jerusalem, and he tries it once and it's a total disaster. Remember, Uzzah reached out and touched the Ark and he got slain by God in a moment. And time passes, and finally David figures out what he needs to do. He finally brings the Ark of the Covenant into the city. There is great, great rejoicing. In 2 Samuel chapter 6, when David comes in to the city, we're told in verse 14, David was dancing before the Lord with all his might, and he was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all the house of Israel were bringing up the Ark of the Lord with shouting and the sound of the trumpet. I believe he was dancing with holy joy. He was so excited that the Lord had blessed him and allowed him to bring this ark into the city. And then it happened, verse 16, that as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, that Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out of the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. I think her problem is she loved David more than she loved David's God. And she realized David had a level of devotion to God that he did not have to her. Do you have that in your own life? Is there any person that you love more than God? It affects the foundation of your marriage. You have, you know, Paul talks about being unequally yoked with unbelievers. I get the metaphor. But sometimes you may have believers who are unequally yoked, where one loves God absolutely and the other one, kind of a half-hearted commitment. If that's what your marriage looks like, you're building on an unequal, unlevel, unstable foundation. Sometimes you have parents who frankly love their children more than they love God. And I'm telling you, that's not how you raise your children. And that won't help your marriage either. Whatever the relationship, you've got to love God so much that you let Him control everything about your life, every relationship, every possession, every priority, every thought, every word, every deed. That's what it means to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. That's not an easy thing. And that's why I took that little detour at the beginning of the sermon. Why is it that in so few places you read about people, particularly in the Old Testament, saying, I love you, Lord? I think it's because they knew how hard it was. Oh, it's the command is there. You are to love the Lord your God. That command is over and over and over and over again. But I think that for many people, they understood exactly how hard that was. Did David love God? Absolutely. Did he always show it? Absolutely not. Did Peter love the Lord? He loved him. But in a weak moment, he failed him colossally. And I think that's why you have that awkward conversation by the Sea of Galilee. Peter, do you agape me? Love me in the highest sense? Well, Lord, I like you a lot. But the Lord restored Peter. And Peter came to know what it meant to love God absolutely. And even though the New Testament doesn't really say much about it, 2 Peter mentions it briefly. From what we know, he died during the persecutions of Nero. He died for his Lord. He came to understand what it meant to love the Lord in every possible way. Let's go to our Father in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you once again for this occasion to be here. We thank you for this beautiful day that you've given to us. All of these things, the opportunities that we have, the blessings that we have, are reminders of your love for us. Lord, help us to love you back. Help us to seat you on the throne of our heart in the highest, most honorable place, and let everything that we think, everything that we decide, everything that we do, reflect the love, the priorities that we have for you. Father, help us never, ever to compromise and put something in your place. Help us to love you in such a way that our families, our children, our friends, our neighbors, and even the unbelievers that we know, help them to see how much we love you by what we do, by what we think, and by how we treat others. Father, thank you for the gift of your Son, and it's in his name that we pray. Amen. If you're here this morning and you've never obeyed Jesus as Lord, you don't love him enough. You need to change your allegiance. You know, one of my favorite commentators, Daniel Block, he's written a number of Old Testament commentaries. He describes the Shema, Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 and 5, as Israel's pledge of allegiance. When you confess Jesus as Lord, you're confessing your allegiance to him. So if you've never obeyed Jesus as Lord and want to become a Christian this morning, please do so. And for those of us who are Christians, are you struggling in your allegiance to God? If so, we can help you with that. Think about that while we stand and sing.